Well, a big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Tuesday, May 6th, and you are listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh.
And coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Alan Cawley and Mark Landon chat Champions League and all the latest European football stories. In athletics, Eoin Reardon brings us up to date on some big performances from Irish stars in Shanghai and Miami. Plus, Aoife Murray and Ursula Jacob join us to discuss the short skirts issue in Camogie.
And we'll round up today's sports news headlines. So if you want to have your say, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200 or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Good evening, Ruby. How's the form?
I'm very good, Shane. How's Alan Cawley looking there across the...
He's alive. He's alive. He's fresh from a small trip over to England with the... Do you know what? Our weekend highlights are usually on a Monday. Alan's usually on a Monday, Ruby, of course. Paul Curry had to sub in because you were out enjoying some big, important victories with the home farm under 12s.
Alan, you'd be proud of Paul. He went for your favourite sport.
Snooker.
No.
Rugby.
Rugby.
Oh, Paul, no. Just when I was about to applaud him and say and thank him for filling in and doing such a brilliant job, as he always does, he picks rugby. Oh,
that
no.
was a cracker of a match.
We'll have words.
You have a cracker of
we
a
will
match.
Have words, me and Paul Curry. We will have words.
I tell you, the Leinster-Northampton match probably served a bit more entertainment then, with respect to Home Farm's big win over Aston Villa.
We'll come to Home Farm in a minute, but I'm not opening up a can of worms, Ruby. But I did say here a few months ago, and I remember it clearly, should Leo Cullen be questioned as a manager when they can't keep getting over the line? And I was told, oh no, no, he's doing a great job and all. So surely he's been questioned.
I'm sure he is, but I'd say he has a fairly lofty sidekick there who's probably under some questions as well.
And why didn't they get over the line this time?
Northampton outplayed them in the end, the decision making. This has been...
Okay, Paul Curry covered it last night.
And Michael Corgan. Jack Nienaber gave a very honest interview that we played out in yesterday's show that you can get back on the podcast, yeah, wherever you get your podcast of Game On as well.
I'm going to listen
with Michael Corcoran.
But yes, Home Farm were in England over the weekend. Obviously the kids under 12, and we had a fabulous weekend. So we were over playing against Derby County, Aston Villa in Bodymore Heath at their training ground on Saturday, and Nottingham Forest on Sunday at their training ground. All thanks to, I have to give a mention to our sponsor as well, Charlie Tracy, CT Stores. He's been absolutely brilliant.
CT yeah. Superstores.
Up around you.
That's around the corner from where I grew up.
There Charlie go, Tracy. Charlie looking
his
after
his son
us.
Used to play in golf for yeah. Kildare County, actually, there Ruby. Go. There's a connection
so
for
his
yourself.
His grandson
as well.
Is involved with us. Played great over the weekend as well. But the lads were absolutely brilliant, and the experience that they had. And I must say, Andy Reid met us on Sunday at the Forest training ground, along with some of the first teamers were there because they were getting ready to travel to play against Brentford on Monday night, on Crystal Palace on Monday night. And Morgan Gibbs-White was an absolute gentleman with all the kids. It just goes to show, when you want to see their faces when they've seen a couple of the first teamers, and he came over and got a couple of pictures. Andy Reid spoke with them in the dressing room for a good 10-15 minutes. They played great over the weekend. We beat Aston Villa as well. I have to throw that one in, Shane. But just in terms of the experience and seeing, I suppose, the other side and all the stuff that we're arguing about in terms of facilities and resources, it's just a different world compared to what we see, I suppose, on a daily basis.
Well, Aston Villa's woes continue because Aston Villa bosses insist they are not happy about the Premier League match against Tottenham being brought forward 2 days to assist the Londoners' preparations for a potential Europa League final appearance. Spurs' request to bring the match forward from its original date of May 18th to May 16th has been granted by the Premier League, with Ange Postecoglou's side in a strong position to reach the continental final on May 21st. So, you know, it all ties in. You know, that's what you teed it up there, Alan, perfectly.
I'd say Emery was really disappointed now with the under-12s at the weekend, so just goes to show.
You teed it up. You were also in your travels to the Crucible, and we were keeping an eye on it last night. Zhao Xingtang was crowned China's first world snooker champion after withstanding a stirring comeback from Mark Williams to complete an 18-12 win at the Crucible. Resumed the final session one frame short of victory. Zhao was forced to wait for his history-making moment as the Welsh veteran reeled off four in a row to stretch the match beyond a mid-session interval. Williams at 50, the oldest finalist in Crucible history, had his chances to further reduce the deficit before Zhao recovered his poise to rocket in match-clinching break of 87 before celebrating by raising the Chinese flag. We can actually hear from Barry Hearn on that victory now.
We're hearing numbers, early numbers, of 150 million audience from Southeast Asia, which is phenomenal. This young man is obviously, you know, back after a short suspension, playing the snooker from the gods. I was so impressed with him last night. It took me back to a very young Jimmy White with the cue action. He's so confident. Mark Williams put up a great fight, especially in the final evening session to win the first four legs. But the young Chinese guy, he was never fazed. He's a real star for the future, and I think he's going to help snooker no end by inspiring millions of kids, in particularly in China, but moreover Southeast Asia, to pick up the cue and see if they can. You know, when you look at the qualifiers for this year's Worlds, 8 out of the 16 qualifiers were Chinese players, and they're only going to be inspired by Zhao's confidence. He's the perfect package, and he's going to be a wonderful ambassador, not just for China, but for snooker generally.
A young Jimmy White, according to Barry Hearn, a young Ronnie O'Sullivan, according to his opponent, Mark Williams. This guy's the real deal, Al.
Oh, he's the real deal, absolutely, Shane. But he's 28, not as young as they're making him out to be. Mm. But and in terms of the future and what it holds for him, absolutely, because his future, I suppose his career was stalled for a spell, and that must be mentioned as well. And he will have people, as much as it's a fantastic achievement and congratulations to him and is a great for the game, you'll still have people will question, I suppose, the fact he was banned for a couple of years.
Yeah, sorry, just to outline that, he is being referred to as the first amateur to claim the title. However, the loss of his tour card is a consequence of his 20-month ban for his involvement in a betting scandal in 2023 does not an amateur make, even if the player is labelled as such by the governing body. Zhao continues to earn his living from the game, and his prize money from Sheffield will lift him to 11th in the world rankings when his card is restored next season, just to give the background on
yeah,
that.
And I think the reason it was lenient, I suppose, the sentence at the time, was because he wasn't directly involved, but there was a number of other players and he was indirectly involved, hence the ban. But in terms of his talent and his ability, Shane, absolutely amazing. He really was. And off the back of those qualifying games that he had, I think he had 12 centuries in qualification in the three games. Then he came in to the tournament as well, and he's been a revelation, really, I suppose. And just the composure he's shown, he is, as I said, he's not as young. I know he looks like a boy, he is 28, but still to be doing that on the world stage, I suppose, and showing the composure that he did playing against the likes of Ronnie O'Sullivan, then Williams in the final, I think the temperament is what stood out for me, along with his ability. So it's a great story. It was going to happen, I suppose, at some time in the near future in terms of the Chinese winner, because the game is just so big over there off the back of Ding Junhui's success. Mm. And it was going to happen. I think we had 10 qualified for the outright draw this year. So, but he looks like the one that's going to carry the flag for them in terms of being a really, really top-notch player going forward. And hopefully his career can go forward in that regard, Shane. Whatever happened in the past, as I say, it was in the past. Let him get on with it now. I think he's learned his lesson. And in terms of his ability, nobody would ever question that or doubt it. Phenomenal story.
Al, as an amateur, does he get the prize money or not?
I'm nearly sure he does, Ruby. I still think he does. They took the professional status off him, off the ban, but and hence that's why he, I suppose, he had to qualify again. But he's a top 8 player, Ruby, you know, and he'll be back in, I suppose, the top ranked player amongst those players now in the next few tournaments once he picks up the points again. But I think he does get the money. But it's more the story, and again, it kind of feeds into the bigger picture of the whole debate around the snooker and will it move out of Sheffield. But for the first time, and I've been quite critical, even though I love Barry Hearn and I think what he's done for the game has been amazing. I didn't like his comments last year, but this year they were a lot more positive. He was interviewed during the tournament there last week by Rishi Prasad, and it was very, very positive in terms of the upgrades that he wants from the Sheffield City Council and the Crucible Theatre. And he more or less said if he gets them, it probably will stay there. And that was a lot more optimistic than what we were hearing last year, because it is, it's an amazing place. It'd be like taking the FA Cup out of Wembley for the final. It'd be like taking the Gold Cup out of Cheltenham, Ruby. Like, it just can't happen and it shouldn't happen. And I hope
they're two stadiums. Cheltenham is continuing to modernise. Wembley has been completely rebuilt, Alan. So, like, I mean, surely to God, the Crucible has to get its finger out and tidy itself up.
Oh, yeah, and that's fine. No one is disputing that, Ruby. The upgrades are needed, but I suppose the debate was the fact that they were going to take it out altogether and move it to the other side of the world. That's why people were kicking up a fuss, and I think that would be the wrong thing to do. But in terms of the upgrades, it absolutely needs that 100%. But they don't own it. I'm not sure there's the racing world own Cheltenham or how that works.
No, Cheltenham's owned by the Jockey Club, so it's owned by shareholders. I don't know who owns Wembley.
So in terms of the upgrades made there, I suppose that's amongst a committee or a team, is it, Ruby, around
it's
that?
Jockey Club Racecourses own it. So, like most HRI owns 4 racecourses in Ireland, the rest of them are privately owned. And in the UK, the BHA, which would be the governing body, doesn't own any racecourse. Jockey Club Racecourses own, I think it's 16. ARC own a huge mount the tracks as well. So York is obviously an independent, Ascot's an independent, but no, the actual governing body doesn't own any race courses. Who owns Wembley?
I'm not sure, but I'm sure the English FA are heavily involved. But just on that as well, Ruby, with the horse racing thing, because that's the flagship, I suppose, week in national hunt racing, it's in their best interest to have the facilities top notch. And I think that's what the players are arguing here, and the prize money for more revenue and more people coming in the door. But I'm all for that, and all for the upgrades that are needed in the Crucible, because it's effectively just a theatre. And but it's brilliant for Sheffield and the area as well around that time. I'd hate to see them lose it, because you associate the snooker with Sheffield. But definitely the upgrades are needed. And I think Barry Hearn for the first time spoke of, I suppose, mutual agreement in terms of that with Sheffield City Council and the Crucible Theatre. And I think he's happy once those upgrades are met that it will stay.
Interestingly, Mark Langdon might be able to answer who owns Wembley, but I can tell you it's a subsidiary, Wembley National Stadium Limited, the Football Association. So the FA currently owns the stadium. The FA headquarters are actually in the stadium itself. So that moves our conversation on to association football nicely. And Mark Langdon does join us on the line as we look forward to Inter-Barça this evening. The first leg was a glorious spectacle for football fans, although Barcelona, a bit like Inter, will have some regrets about the income. Will tonight be half as entertaining, Mark?
Even if it's half as entertaining, Shane, it'll still be a wonderful watch. I mean, the first half last week might have been the best 45 minutes of football this season. Probably a bit of recency bias in there. I can't remember every half of football that's been played this season, but it was just phenomenal, really. The quality of goals that Inter scored was just fantastic. But the way that Barcelona responded with Lamine Yamal, the catalyst, for that comeback, it was sort of hard, I think, at the end of that game to just work out kind of who was the happier, because, you know, Barcelona were 2-0 down at one stage. So I think at that point, you're happy to come out of there with a draw. Inter have scored 3 goals, which probably, you know, 2 or 3 more than they would have expected to, given they came into the game in terrible form. So they'll be happy that they got the draw, but they'll also be kicking themselves slightly that they got their noses in front twice. They also had a goal disallowed for the tightest of offsides as well. So I think that the game is just set up to be full of goals, because Barcelona only know how to play one way. They would just, either home or away, they would just play on the front foot, defend on the halfway line, and try to, you know, just score 2, 3, 4 goals. They've done it all season. Inter, much more disciplined with the way that they try to attack. But at set pieces, they've just got a massive advantage over Barcelona. And every time they get a corner, free kick, or a throw-in near that Barcelona box, it's going to be sort of panic stations for Barca. So I think it's set up absolutely beautifully for a really close and thrilling night.
Al, what about Lamine Yamal?
Where do we even start, Ruby? It's scary, it really is, I suppose. The scariest part for me, on top of his ability, and I mentioned it even there about Zhao Jingtong, it's the temperament. And he did a press conference before the match, which is rare enough in the sense that they're quite diplomatic and robotic, I suppose, some of the players and the answers that's generally give before a match. But he was more or less saying, telling everybody, just calm down, I have this. Mm. And talk about heaping pressure on yourself before a match, especially for one so young, and a match as big as, I suppose, the Champions League semi-final. And then to go out and deliver the performance that he did and back up everything that he was more or less saying, and the confidence and the arrogance that he shows, but he carries it so well. It's just phenomenal at 17 years of age. I seen him live last year, Ruby. I actually covered a game for, it was the Euros under 17, and Ireland played against him. And actually Corey O'Sullivan, who's playing for Shamrock Rovers now, marked him at left full. And everybody was speaking about this lad, the fact that he had featured in Barcelona's first team. And Corey O'Sullivan did a really good job on him. But I suppose the stratospheric rise since that, a couple of years back, to him performing to the level that he is, even at 17 now, it's just no one would have believed it. And the one thing as well that sticks out for me, and often telly doesn't do it justice, but the physical size of him as well, he looks like an absolute specimen for one so young. But it's just the way he carries himself, Ruby, on top of the ability, the goal that he scored last week, along with his general play, it's absolutely phenomenal. And he's become their main man and talisman, really. And I always felt that this day would come where he would be all that, but maybe in 3-4 years' time. It's actually here now, because everybody thought after Ronaldo and Messi that Mbappe would step into that breach and he'd become, I suppose, the best player. Hasn't quite worked out as well, I suppose, for him in that regard. Still a phenomenal player, but I think Yamal has nearly overtaken him now in that regard, and getting to that that level of being possibly the best player in the world.
Well, let's hear from Barcelona manager now, Hansi Flick, on the wonder kid that is Lamine Yamal.
Lamine's a genius. What he's doing with the ball, it's unbelievable. And every pass is with the right pressure, with the right length, and it's really unbelievable. With 17 years, and for me, it was the match on Wednesday when he brought us back with his actions and with his goal. It was really good to see. But you have to show that. It's now the second leg and a very important leg, because we want to reach the final. This is our goal, and we need everyone on the highest level against this fantastic team of Inter.
Mark, he's 17 years of age, 291 days. He's 76 starts for Barca, 22 goals, 27 assists, and played 100 games. Lionel Messi was 20 and 248 days old by the time he'd achieved that. It's incredible.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that at 17, Yamal is way clear of kind of what Messi was showing. You know, he was only just about sort of being given minutes for Barcelona. It was a very different Barcelona team, though, that Messi came into. Ronaldinho and Deco, just these huge personalities, wasn't a great dressing room. Took Guardiola a bit of time to kind of get rid of the people that he didn't want. The culture probably wasn't right for bringing through a 17-year-old at sort of that point, really. I think this is a different Barcelona. But yeah, Yamal is way clearer of what Messi was doing at 17. What Messi did, though, was he did it for 15 years. And so, you know, and Hansi Flick just said it there, didn't he? You know, we need Yamal to be on this level for the second leg, and then next season, the season after. So that, I think, is the hard bit, really. You know, you can reach a level, but can you play at that level, you know, even for a whole season or 2 years? But at the moment, I mean, he's the Ballon d'Or favourite, which, you know, for a 17-year-old, is just truly astonishing. His teammate might have something to say about that, because on the opposite side, Rafinha is, you know, in terms of numbers, he's outdoing Lamine Yamal this season. He was unlucky not to score in the first leg. So Lewandowski's been sort of struggling with injury, but they've still got goal threats all over the pitch. And Yamal's definitely one of them, but I would also just give a shout out for how good Rafinha's been this season as well.
Yeah, Ousmane Dembele in the running as well, who I can confirm is fit for the second leg against Arsenal. That team news coming in today, this afternoon, from PSG. So not ideal for Arsenal tomorrow. However, we are focusing on this evening's match as well. Alan, who's going to prevail? Who's going to qualify? You backed Inter. I'm holding you to it. You backed Inter in our women's national team match out in Talla Stadium, if I recall correctly, to go all the way.
Well, I said at that time, because of, I suppose, I think we were still at the quarter-final stage, or even before that it might have been, but I just felt there would have been a real danger to a lot of the top teams as such, as we've seen now, obviously, with them going against Barcelona. So it was more a dark horse. But from a selfish point of view, Shane, I'm going to the final. Okay. And I want to see Barcelona and PSG, because I think the football that both of them teams are playing right now at this moment, and it's rare it happens in cup competition that you get the best two teams get to the final, and I think they're the best two teams that I've seen all season. Especially PSG have been absolutely incredible in some of the games that I've seen, obviously against Liverpool and that, and I think they'll prevail against Arsenal. But certainly for this one tonight, I do think Inter are a very good team. I like Inzaghi. Mark mentioned that there had been a little bit of a sticky patch before the first leg, but they got a win in the league at the weekend against Verona. I think that'll give them huge confidence to draw last week away from home as well. So I think it's going to be a tough night for Barcelona, a really tough night, and there's nothing better than passionate Italians fighting for something. It's a great sight to see, and I think it'll be all that in the San Siro. But just from a selfish point of view, I would like to see Barcelona prevail, because I think Barcelona and PSG could possibly be the best Champions League final we've seen in years.
Mark, obviously Barca conceded 3 last weekend, but they've also conceded 4 of their last 5 away games in the Champions League. Who do you think will win?
Yeah, I don't think Barcelona will keep a clean sheet, even if they win. You know, it's just not really the way that they do it. I think I'd edge towards Barcelona as well, and I don't know if that's my sort of, you know, just a bias there, because like Alan, I'd really like to see Barcelona PSG in the final. Lautaro Martinez, I don't think the teams have been announced just yet, but Lautaro Martinez is definitely not fully fit. And you know, if he is risked by Inter, and you can understand why they might chance him, because it, you know, the season depends on this game, I think that would be a significant blow that, you know, he's not quite at 100% and could be rushed back for this game. And I never like that when you see teams sort of being that desperate to play their star players. I would say more often than not, it doesn't work out. But certainly when he came off injured last week, there was very little chance that he was given of being fit 6 days later. And now the talk was initially that maybe he will. So if he does start, I don't think he's fully fit. If he doesn't start, he's Inter's, you know, most influential player. So I would edge towards Barcelona, but you know, it could easily be another sort of 3-2 or something like that.
Mark, just sticking with Barcelona, La Liga finally poised ahead of El Clasico next weekend?
Yeah, so Barcelona can afford to lose the Clasico and still win La Liga after the weekend that they got the win. But Real Madrid just kept the pressure on, scored two brilliant goals, Mbappe and Güler, the young Turkish player, against Celta Vigo, just to keep keep Barcelona honest. And what you would say is that if they do reach the Champions League final, it's another game to prepare for. And it's difficult to juggle in so many different competitions. So, you know, it was important that Real Madrid made sure that they didn't hand it to Barcelona and at least made, you know, the weekend game important enough, really. And not ideal for Barcelona to have such a big game on Tuesday and then another one on Saturday that could well decide the title.
Al, Harry Kane finally won a trophy at Bayern Munich, won the Bundesliga. Could it be the year the Spurs win a European trophy too, though?
Well, they've given themselves a great chance, Ruby, but it wouldn't surprise me if Spurs go through the tournament like they have and then slip up with the final hurdle after the season that they've had. So it looks like it'll be United in the final against them. I wouldn't write Bodo Glimt off just yet. That late goal that they got last Thursday, I think, gives them hope, gives them a chance.
Tough and, place to go, the Arctic Circle.
And that's it. Like, and
notoriously.
It absolutely is, Shane. And if you look at, I suppose, their home form in European competition as well, it's absolutely phenomenal. It's up there with the best of teams around Europe. It's an artificial pitch as well, Ruby, which is not ideal, so I don't think it'll be an easy night for Spurs, but they do have the 2-goal lead, which should get them the job done. But because of, I suppose, the tumultuous season that they've had and the roller coaster ride that it's been, and Postecoglou having trouble at every corner that he's turned to, really, it's all on this. It's literally all on this. And I think the pressure that they're under to win a European competition as well, for financial reasons, and get into the Champions League, there's huge pressure on them. So I think they'll just edge the game on Thursday night and get through. But I still can't see them winning it. I've thought that all season, no matter who to go against in the final, even though I don't think Man United are a good team either. I think they're very poor. I think it'll be a poor enough final. It'll be good from an interest point of view and we'll all be glued to it. But I think it's two poor teams. But I don't think Spurs will win it out, no.
Mark, would you agree with Arsene Wenger that the Europa League title is not deserving of a place in the Champions League qualification?
No, I would disagree. And look, if it does end up being Spurs v Manchester United final, I can understand why people would think that neither of those two teams deserve to be playing Champions League next season. But, you know, over the last 20 years, it's not been mentioned that often. And I know that the competition is slightly weaker these days because we've got an extended Champions League. You don't get those Champions League dropouts. But I've always felt that was completely unfair, that 8 teams just suddenly sort of parachuted into a competition after failing in another one. Don't remember anyone last year saying Atalanta didn't deserve to be in the Champions League. And yeah, it's not been a vintage competition this season, but sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. I think you would devalue the Europa League if you didn't offer that carrot of kind of the Champions League football at the end. So I think it means you've got a better competition for having one spot. And it's not ideal that you could potentially have 16 from one country in the Champions League, but I think that there's lots of problems with kind of the distribution of the Champions League as it is, and I don't think the Europa League is the biggest of those sort of hurdles or handicaps.
Yeah, I'd imagine that's the biggest argument against it, Al, the devaluing the competition. You don't want teams putting out their second string teams to the Europa League, which already happens as is.
Yeah, no, I would agree with Mark. I think it is, I suppose, something that they're all aiming for, and it's a right thing as well. And there hasn't been any talk about it in the last number of years if a team qualified. So I would agree with Mark on that one. One I would agree with, though, I saw during the week, where a team like Chelsea shouldn't be in the Conference League. That's something I think that's a bigger issue when you think of the money that they have and the financial kind of turnover that they have compared to maybe the teams, because that was built for the likes of our league, Shane, and teams like that. So when you see Chelsea competing in that, I don't think that's right. But certainly in terms of the Europa League and the qualification for the Champions League, I think that's right and fair. I'd have no problem with that.
Okay, we mentioned Barcelona who are playing tonight and La Liga, so Inter and Serie A, Mark. However, Napoli took another step towards a second Serie A title in three seasons by beating relegation-threatened Lecce. 3-point advantage remains after Inter also won, but Napoli firmly in the driving seat.
Yeah, Raspadori free kick, got the job done. Not the prettiest of games, but you sometimes get those type of matches at this stage of the season. I think actually you get those type of matches with Antonio Conte in charge anyway, really. He's not that interested in sort of how you win as long as you win. So it was a big 3 points. Like you say, that they can afford even kind of a draw somewhere in these last three matches. So, I mean, they really are on the verge of a title. And I think it would be just a brilliant achievement from them to lose Kvaratskhelia in January and Osimhen in the summer and still be able to do this. Neres as well, one of their wingers, has been injured for a large part of the season. Like, he did, this shouldn't be underestimated what they're attempting to do. They have been helped by the fact that Inter were fighting on three fronts and now find themselves really only sort of left in the Champions League. So maybe they could have rotated a bit more throughout the season, but that's not Napoli's fault. They've taken full advantage, and sort of not having European football, I think, has certainly helped them in terms of this season.
Okay, just going around Europe, Alan Colley, I see in Turkey, Ali Gunnar Solskjaer's Besiktas oversaw a derby win against Jose Mourinho's Fenerbahce, dent in Fenerbahce's title pursuit, chasing Galatasaray. However, interesting comments from Ali. Can't understand how United let McTominay go. Player who always gives 100% for the shirt. I suppose the counter-argument to that is that it's 100% profit because he came through the academy. Harry Maguire, Bruno Fernandes and Victor Lindelof, the only players I heard from, says Ali.
I saw that, yeah.
Am I too sentimental to be like, ah, oh, lads?
I saw the interview, Shane, yeah, and the comments that he made. I'd agree with him on McTominay as well. Now, not that I think McTominay is going to change Man United's fortunes in terms of getting them back to the levels that they were at, but I don't think he should have been the one that maybe kind of saw the door. But he's gone on to great things, and you were just speaking about Napoli. He looks like he's going to win a league, and he's been absolutely brilliant over there for them. So I don't think he's going to look back with too much regret, McTominay. He's kind of gotten on with it. But the lads getting in touch with him, yeah, they're the ones, I suppose, that Ole was loyal to, that I don't think he should have been loyal to. So it's no coincidence that they're texting him. They threw him under the bus then after, I suppose, when he was struggling. But that doesn't surprise me, Shane. You stay in touch with some managers, you don't stay in touch with other managers. It wasn't exactly the greatest time when he was there. There was a period, I suppose, where it was going well, and then to finish second in that Champions League win against PSG, but overall it wasn't great. And I'm glad to see him go on and do kind of good things with his career. He's still a young manager, he's still finding his way. Beating Mourinho in that match as well is good for him, so hopefully he can kind of revive his career and get back to some sort of level, and you might see him back in the Premier League one day. But it doesn't surprise me about lads not texting him, no. I wouldn't be texting him either.
Or would you not? C'est la vie, Alan Colley. Oh, you're staying with us. Mark Langdon, thank you very much for taking our call. Before we go to the break, Rhys McLennan has been forced to withdraw from this month's European Championships because of an unspecified injury, but he does plan on being back for the World Championships in October. We have a break to take. Ian O'Riordan is up next.
Game on. Athletics.
Now, athletics correspondent with the Irish Times, Ian O'Riordan, joins us now to reflect on some big performances in both Miami and Shanghai over the weekend and look forward to the World Relays in China this coming weekend. Let us begin our conversation with a third place finish by Andrew Coskren in the 5,000 metre event at the Miami Grand Slam track meet, because that was enough to secure second place overall in the long distance event and earn Coskren, not too shabby, $50,000, which equates to 44,200 euros. So it's not a bad payday for Andrew Coskren.
Don't forget, if Koskren can come second, he'll have the same points as Fisher, but points, but time-wise, he's nowhere near. There's Koskren in the yellow, the Irishman on the shoulder of the Olympic silver medalist. George Mills looks a little bit spent at the back of that group now, so he's not going to get amongst the big money. At the front, it's all about Fisher, but Koskren will be hoping he can at least get second here. He's got no chance of winning the slam, even if he does come second. One last look round for Fisher. Now he can wave to the crowd, enjoying these last 50 metres. This has been a display. This has been absolutely emphatic. The slam winner, Grant Fisher, scrapped for second place. It's going to be Couppetier who just gets second, I think, ahead of Koskren.
So Ian O'Riordan, not a bad payday for Andrew Koskren. Put this into context for us. How big a performance was it for the Balbriggan athlete?
Yeah. Good evening, Shane. Now, a very good run by Andrew Koskren there on Friday. He'd won the 3,000 metres, first of all, on Friday, and then he came back and finished third into 5,000 metres on Sunday. And I'm conscious some people are kind of going, Grand Slam track, what is that? I mean, this is an entirely new competition this year, dreamed up by Michael Johnson, the American 400 meter runner. I mean, I suppose the key is in the name, Grand Slam track. It's only track, no field. So I'm not saying people are put off by field events in any way, but this is only focusing on the track, short sprints, hurdles, up to the middle distance events. But the key is this big prize money as well. There's about $12 million across four meetings, including $100,000 for each winner in each meeting over the course of the last 3 or 4 weeks. And this is where Andrew Cochran got his $50,000, which is to say, like, it's not, compared to some of the other pro sports, it's not huge money. We won't mention golf money or anything like that, but it's a big payday for Andrew, and certainly for any other athletes who kind of can go the whole season not making a whole lot of money. He's probably made that amount in one weekend, and it's great publicity. It's great exposure for him as well. It's I know it's shown on a lot of US television. It's been shown here on TNT. And look, I was a little bit skeptical myself at the beginning, saying, will this work? And does the sport need this kind of slightly jazzed up event? But so far, I think it's definitely been a breath of fresh air. I mean, there's no pacemakers. It's just eight runners and all across the events. You've got what's called the four racers. These are athletes who are contracted versus the four challengers. And Cochran is one of the challengers. And it certainly makes for really exciting races. And we saw that on Friday, where Cochran came through to win, I think, by the width of his vest. And then on Sunday, he was a little bit behind Grant Fisher from the USA. He went on to win the $100,000. But it's certainly every race kind of unfolds in that kind of unpredictable and exciting way.
Ian, this is obviously a challenge to the Diamond League. Financially, how does it stand up against the Diamond League?
Yeah, good question. I mean, they're not saying it's so much a challenge to the Diamond League as maybe something, it's an option that can certainly run parallel. Because World Athletics, by the way, more or less run the Diamond League. They support this. They think anything that's good to promote the sport, essentially. And it doesn't really directly conflict, even though there was a Diamond League meeting in Shanghai on Saturday. But I mean, the money compared to the Diamond League is, I mean, it's night and day. I mean, 12 million, as I say, across the four meetings. I mean, you can win more money in one Grand Slam meeting than you could win over the entire Diamond League season. So that was Michael Johnson's aim, really. All along he was saying his athletes are overraced and underpaid, and let's give them some of the money that they deserve.
Speaking of the Diamond League, Rashida Adeleke produced a strong finish to finish second in the 200 metres at the Shanghai Diamond League on Saturday. How impressive was Rashida's performance, Ian?
Yeah, I'd say for this time of year, it was exactly what you would have wanted. I mean, the main point to make is this is a very strange athletic season, because it might feel like sort of high summer out there right now, but the season goes right through to the middle of September, the end of September, when the World Championships are on in Tokyo. So it's a really long season, and everyone is trying to gauge their efforts over the course of the season to see where it'll be in September, which is still over, what, four odd months away. So for Rashida particularly, she ran at 200 metres. Like, she's just testing the legs, testing the speed a little bit. Didn't get a great start by her own admission, but finished really strongly to come through in about 22 points. She ran 22.7, so she's still some way off her best. But this is all building up to the World Relays, World Athletics Relays, which are also on in China. They're on in Guangzhou starting this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So it was a kind of a tune-up for that. So I'd say she'll be happy enough. Funny enough, a lot of her rivals are actually running in the Grand Slam track. And, you know, they're reading off some very fast times. We saw Marilady Paulino, who won the World Championships and the Olympics, running a really fast 200 metres. So I suppose the hope is, for Adeleke's point of view, that maybe they're peaking a little bit too soon and they might be a little bit burnt out by September. But for her, I think by her own admission, her start wasn't great, but she finished strong. She's in the middle of a really heavy training block, all geared towards the summer. And I think from that point of view, everything is going according to plan.
Obviously, Rhodesia is in the right part of the world. She'll be joined by Charlene Mosley, Sophie Becker and Phil Healy for the women's 4x400 metres at those relay championships next weekend. How would you rate the Irish chances?
Well, these world relays are a strange thing. They've only really kind of caught on the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. But now they've become quite central, because this is all about qualifying for the Olympics or the World Championships or whatever it is. And we saw last year they qualified for, obviously, the Paris in the mixed 4x4 and also the women's 4x4, who went on to finish an unbelievably close fourth in the final. I don't think anybody saw that one coming. So they'll be competing this weekend now with the same ambition. Number one, to qualify for Tokyo, which I mentioned, not till the end of September. There's also medals and prize money on offer. And I think they want to step up a little bit now. Like that quartet you mentioned there, like Adeleke, Maudsley, Becker and Healy, they're the four women who finished fourth in the world in the Olympics last year. And since then, by the way, like Maudsley and Becker have been bumped up to the top grant. They're now on the 40,000 Sport Ireland maximum podium grant on the back of their relay performances, essentially. So there's clearly now a better, more emphasis on the Irish relay chances, but that also brings a bit of expectations. But look, I mean, I'd be very surprised if the women's 4x4 and the mixed 4x4 don't qualify this weekend. Depends then what Adeleke decides to do in the final. Would she focus on the mixed or the women's 4x4? Because she's not going to do both because they're on the same day, the finals. So I think there's definitely a medal position there. But as I say, there's really an expectation now. I mean, years ago, Irish teams would go to the relays and you'd be thinking, well, maybe if one of the top teams drop a baton or if somebody runs out of their lane, they might have a chance. But no, they're definitely going over there as one of the teams to be watched and one of the teams to be feared. And I think Adeleke is definitely ready to show what she's capable of doing in the 400 metres, which is her first real kind of 400 metre test this year, even though it is in a relay.
Just on the funding you mentioned for Charlene Maudsley and Sophie Becker, and indeed Chris O'Donnell, who got that podium funding of 40 grand from Sport Ireland. Am I way off the mark, or is it a case of that the likes of O'Donnell, Maudsley, Becker will be expected to perhaps shelve any individual championship aspirations for the greater success of relay teams, but perhaps not Rashida Adeleke?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, that's certainly the assumption. I suppose the problem is for someone like Charlene Maudsley is, I mean, the mixed relay will always come first. So that's the tricky one. The individual relays, as in the women's or the men's, they come at the end. So it's not so much of a dilemma then. I mean, you can focus on that because it's at the end of the program anyway. And as we saw last year at the Olympics, Adeleke did not run the mixed 4x4 heats. And as it turns out, Ireland didn't even qualify for the final. So that wasn't even an option if she was going to run or not. But for the likes of Chris O'Donnell, I would certainly say yes, that if he's selected for the relays, that should be his priority. Sophie Becker too. And that's why for Maudsley, it's a slightly more interesting dilemma to see what she's going to do now, because she certainly has improved a lot in the individual event and is well capable of making a final in the World Championships if that was her priority. But I mean, it certainly seems to be now this year, anyway, that the relay will take precedence for those three.
And we obviously have a new Irish men's marathon record too, Peter Lynch, 2:09:36. Good clock.
Yeah, no, that was a great performance by Peter Lynch. I mean, he's been one of these athletes who's been coming through. I remember seeing him winning a school's cross-country medal in a muddy field in Sligo years ago. And you're kind of thinking, God, it's a long way from there to where he's got now. He went to college in America down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And then he's just been not chipping away. And like, he's only 27. And years ago, people would kind of move up to the marathon in their 30s and when they were kind of coming to the end of their career. But this new generation now are kind of moving up to the marathon a bit younger. And like, it's 2:09. Look, we all know it's still not. It's not going to threaten any world records yet, but it'll probably qualify him for Tokyo as well in the World Championships. And it's funny, we kind of thought that maybe Irish marathon standards were dropping off a little bit. They've certainly leveled off a bit. Now, he only knocked 6 seconds or 8 seconds off the mark by Hiko Tanosa, but I definitely think he's an athlete to watch. And there's no reason why he couldn't get down to maybe a 2:06 over the next 3 or 4 years, which is certainly getting a lot closer to where the top boys are running.
Okay, great stuff. Just to give a mention as well to Brian Fay, who ran a season's best time in the Diamond League last weekend as well, 13:12.10. We are taking a short ad break. Ian O'Riordan, Irish Times athletics correspondent, thank you so much for joining us. We are chatting camogie. We're chatting shorts versus skorts with Ursula Jacob and Aoife Murray after the break. Stick with us here in Game On 2FM.
Game On. Camogie.
Now, Kilkenny will play Wexford in a Leinster final after both teams won their Leinster semi-finals last weekend. This weekend, Cork will play Waterford in a Munster final, 3:45 throw-in in Cusack Park and Ennis. And the Ulster final scheduled for Sunday, Antrim play Derry at 1 p.m. However, the larger story dominating the news headlines was the protest between Dublin and Kilkenny players, and even more recently, Laois Camogie players also joined the protest in the Leinster Intermediate Camogie semi-final. Ursula Jacob, Aoife Murray join us on the line. Just to give a bit of background to our listeners, if anyone isn't aware of the situation regarding this. So Camogie players from Dublin and Kilkenny were forced to change into skorts before their Leinster semi-final in Blanchardstown on Saturday after turning up in shorts as a protest. Both sides stood on the pitch in shorts ahead of the national anthem, but referee Ray Kelly informed team managers Tommy Shefflin and Jerry McQuaid that the match would be abandoned if the players did not change. After a delay of several minutes, both sets of players reappeared in skorts for a game Kilkenny won 4-11 to 2-12. Camogie players must wear skorts, shorts with a panel of fabric that makes them have the appearance of a skirt under the association's rules. Aoife, Ursa, thank you both so much for joining us. Ursa, if we come to you first, because you were very outspoken on this issue on Twitter, and you released a bit of a statement, and you have obviously high standing in the game, a former Wexford Camogie player as well. You feel very strongly on this issue that it shouldn't be an issue, really. They should have the choice.
Yeah, I think that's the big message coming from what I've been saying the last couple of days, is I think choice. We get so many choices in our life, and I suppose in relation to Camogie as well, I feel there should be a choice. Now, look, we know all about the GPA doing surveys, and it was only covering inter-county players. And I would like to gauge, you know, how club players are feeling too. And I'm sure there is some players who have no issue wearing the scarf, but the general consensus out there does seem to be that players find the current skirts uncomfortable, inappropriate in lots of ways, and they are looking for that change. And I suppose you can sense the frustration from so many of the players now, because they feel like their voices are not being heard. And also, you know, obviously we're aware that Congress happened last year and the motion failed, and it won't be looked at again till 2027. And in my own opinion, I think that's too long, that's too far away, because I've said it kind of the last couple of days and even last year, if this current skirt rule deters one player from playing, well, that's one player too many. You know, our Camogie community is small enough as it is. We can't afford to be losing any more players. And if this is a barrier to certain girls playing Camogie, well, then I think it has to be urgently looked at. And they can't wait two more years for it to happen.
Aoife, being one of the most decorated players that Cork have ever produced, and just again to give a bit more background, two separate motions at last year's Congress, which would have either replaced skorts with shorts or allowed both, were defeated and cannot be put forward again until 2027, as Ursula outlined there. And the GPA survey of inter-county players, 83% of players believe that they should have the option to choose. Was it an issue in your playing days, Aoife?
Well, I think if anybody saw the scores I played in, they probably would definitely want to vote it out, to be honest with you. I think I got Sarah Durbin of Galway always had a good pop at me for just how unsightly it was, simply because I actually think I played in the scores I got in 2006, right? It was like something out of, you know, like a baby's comforter, where the baby now is 20 odd years of age and they still have it and it's a little rag. That was probably more so what I had played in up to about 2018, the end of 2018, simply because I could not change over to the new form of skorts. The one I had was comfortable. It was very much something that I was happy to wear. And I always have to say this from my own personal perspective, I am pro-skorts. When we changed over to the new form of skort, it was extremely uncomfortable, right? You're there, you're training really hard, you know, especially, I suppose, for myself, you're working really hard to get fit into a physical condition. You're a size X, and then you go into trying to fit into a skort. You could be 3-4 sizes difference in the upward scale rather than the downward scale. And I think that for me really hit me towards the latter end of my career. And I'm still pro sport. What I would hate to think is we lose something that was a part of the fundamental foundations of our sport. Yes, I know we can call it archaic, but I would hate to think that we would allow some of the sports manufacturers to not do their job properly, and that we don't hold them accountable for making clothes, in particular female sport players, making it and manufacturing it appropriately for the women and girls who are actually going to be playing in it. And that's something that I've always said on, look, I think this time last year after the Congress, I voiced my opinion on it, that I know there's a working group in place now, but again, I would call on the association to give us far more transparency over this working group. Who's in it? When was it established? Who have they gone out to? What did that RFP look like? What's the timing of it? Who, and especially, are there players involved in this working group, right? But again, I'd harp back to, I would hate to think that we lose sight of manufacturers not making sporting clothes appropriate for women and girls playing sport.
That's a very good point. Ursula, when you think of Congress not, or this motion failing at Congress twice, who exactly is Congress, and is there a player representation in Congress?
Well, you see, obviously each county has their representatives there. I suppose the big concern for me is how reflective is the voting of each of the counties. Obviously, each county, whether it's Wexford, Cork, Kilkenny, Dublin, you'll have a certain amount of personnel that go up and represent their county and have a number of votes. I would be very curious to know, in relation to the SCART rule, was it consistent across the board that the county board executives that were representing each county, you know, fed back into the clubs to see what the general feeling was amongst the players? It's all well and good saying they spoke to maybe three or four players at underage level or at senior level, but I think there does need to be consultation with club players as well, because they're just as important. It's not just the inter-county scene. This is across the board, right from underage club players up onto, you know, inter-county senior players. So my big concern with Congress is, is it always reflective of how the players in each county is, or is it the opinions of the personnel that's representing the county? And that's a big, big thing for me, because I think there might be a little bit of a disconnect there. So it would be interesting to see. And I think probably there needs to be, fair enough, there was a survey done by the GPA on inter-county players, but do the Camogie Association have to do a survey across the board that includes all players, and then we're getting the feedback right across the board? Now, that would involve a certain amount of work, but I think it's worth the investment in time to really see how the players are feeling, because then the players will feel like they're getting a voice, and that might ease some of the frustration. But I definitely think there needs to be more transparency there as well, because as Aoife said, you know, it's all well and good saying there's working groups and that, but what's the timeline here for the working group? What's the results? What's the actions taken? Who's involved in the working group? I think it needs to be a little bit more clear than it is at the moment.
Good timing from RTGA reporter Damien Lawler. Just on that point, as Ursula again, as Ursula outlined about the Camogie Association not able to revisit the issue until 2027. However, RT Sport understands that some counties are exploring requesting an exemption or relaxation of a rule on the matter. Counties considering this approach have focused on the sections surrounding administrative structures, powers and duties of the organisation. Specifically, Rule 10.5C of the Camogie Association's official guide states that Ard Cóirlea may consider derogation requests from a specific rule where strict adherence to the rule may not be in the best interests of the association. It also clarifies that such applications must be accompanied by supporting evidence as set out by Ard Cóirlea. So obviously a developing story, and just looking ahead at the Munster final, Aoife, you would imagine there could be more protests, and even, I know Dublin and Kilkenny players still took to the field in skorts, but if you were to stop a Munster final in Cusack Park in Ennis and the players took to the field and didn't play, that's going to have long lasting ramifications, you would imagine.
I know, God love the referee for the next few days, trying to get himself ready for the weekend. Look, at the end of the day, I suppose this is a provincial championship. It's not a part of the national competitions, national league and the actual championship, right? So you could look at it one way is, if you're going to take it to the next level, wear skorts and abandon the game. Or wear shorts, apologies, and just abandon the game, right? So you could take, you know, is it on the teams going out this weekend and the following weekend, whether it is the Leinster, Ulster or Munster final? I would say either just go for it, wear your shorts and abandon the game. That wouldn't be long getting that derogation to the 10.5C or whatever it is. That won't be long getting to it, albeit not a national competition. So you probably have that little bit of freedom to be able to do it. I think it's a pity, if that happens. Cork and Waterford, I think it's going to be a cracking game played in the rag. I think what championship is at 2 and 3 weeks out, I think it's going to be a super game for both players, both sets of players. But also, it's the real news, which is the actual camogie that's happening on the field. And it's such a pity that we consistently come back to maybe more off the field or administrative conversations and discussions, when I think you're going to have some cracking games over the next couple of weekends. And I cannot wait for all of the media that's been so passionate about this for the last few days, people reposting and posting. I can't wait for them to open up the doors and have so much more promotion of camogie for the rest of the year, if they are really that passionate about camogie. I think it should be a fantastic, as a promotional year for what happens on the field.
Some very good points. Very well made, Aoife. Thanks a million. Thank you, Ursula, as well. Alan Cawley, have we got soccer news?
We do, Ruby. Yeah, the teams are in. And I suppose Mark was mentioning earlier the worry for Inter Milan. Would Martinez playing? Well, he is playing. Lautaro Martinez leads the line with Thuram for Inter Milan. And on the other side of the pitch, Lewandowski, who I thought would be back for this, Ruby. I know he's had his hamstring troubles, but they thought he'd be fit. He's not playing, so Ferran Torres is up top. The slight little worry I would have for Barcelona, three of the regular back four are missing, so Cubarsí is the only one, and he's young and inexperienced despite the fact that he's a brilliant player. But they're missing Koundé, Balde and Araujo. He's on the bench, Araujo. So three out of their normal back four is not playing. I still fancy Barcelona, but I think it'll be a tough night for them.
Okay, great stuff. Alan Cawley, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to all our listeners for tuning in. Game On is back from 6 o'clock tomorrow. Big thanks to Andrew O'Connor, this evening's producer. Laura Lee Davis was our broadcast coordinator. For myself and Ruby and all of the Game On team, have a great evening. Betta De Silva is up next, so do not go anywhere on 2FM. Game On's back from 6 tomorrow.
RTE 2FM. Right now, this is 2FM's Game On. This is 2FM.